You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of June 2016 on Monocle 24. Coming to you live from Studio One here in London, this is Midori House. Coming up today...
I'm in favour of the benefits that it brings to our society, but I have to say that what is happening at the moment is being done completely without the consent of the British people.
Why has immigration emerged as the Brexit hot topic that may yet tip the scales, especially among voters in areas where there are very few migrants? Also ahead today, is it time the US Republican Party united behind Donald Trump? Well, not so fast, according to House Speaker Paul Ryan.
The last thing I would do is tell anybody to do something that's contrary to their conscience. Of course I wouldn't do that.
Of course not, Paul. Plus, what's in the in tray of Rome's new anti-establishment mayor? That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at RUSI, and Raffaella Pantucci, Associate Fellow at the International Centre for the Study of Radicalisation at King's College London. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us. Now, if you've ever waited for a bus in Rome, you'll know it can take a while, so probably better to take a seat, except that with crumbling essential services, there often isn't a seat to be taken. Likely that's just part of the reason the Italian capital voted in a new mayor at the weekend. Virginia Raggi won by something of a landslide, 67% of the vote. The anti-establishment five-star movement ran on a platform of anti-corruption and promises to fix the city's deteriorating public services. Needless to say, Rome's first female mayor has something of a job ahead. Shashank, starting with you first of all, but before we talk about the specifics of Raggi's success and maybe some of the implications internally within Italy, is this part of a broader trend that we're seeing in mayoral elections, local elections, federal and nationwide, of, you know, anti-establishment, often populist parties making significant gains and potentially heralding, you know, something more, a more significant shift politically?
Well, there's undoubtedly a populist wave that we can see within parties, even new parties cropping up across Europe, but not just Europe. I mean, of course, we see examples within the Labour Party in places like Greece, Spain, austerity hit left-wing populists. But I think cities are really interesting spaces which are ripe for this kind of populist movement, where things like third issues, you know, neither left nor right, municipal services, garbage collection, corruption, these things can really take hold very easily. I think back to India, where a year ago, a populist Aam Aadmi Party, the Ordinary Man Party, won Delhi's local elections and now runs the national capital region. They can't win nationally, they can't win in rural areas, but what they can do is capitalise on disgruntled, lower middle class votes on these non-traditional areas. So really, I think it is global, and I think cities are somewhere where we will see different kinds of electorates and national electorates throw up some pretty strange and interesting parties.
And Raffaella, I guess that's an interesting point, because people, when there's a notable success in a city, as Shashank describes, it will are naturally quick to often say, you know, does this presage a change on the national level? What about the five-star movement, for example? Beppe Grillo, who's not so involved anymore, you know, he's a comedian, it was a protest vote. Is this a comedy party that's gone serious with this result?
Well, I mean, I think the five-star movement, Movimento Cinque Stelle, has been a sort of part of Italian politics for some time now. You know, this is not new. Beppe Grillo has been around for a few years. He's been rallying from the sidelines. I mean, I'd actually take it a bit further than what Shashank was saying and say that, you know, actually, I'd argue that you are seeing these sort of populist movements all over the place at a national level. I'd argue what we're fighting at the moment in here in the UK in terms of the Brexit and Remain conversation has elements of this within it. If we look at the American political cycle and the sort of rise of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, I think that reflects on a kind of national scale. I think that you're seeing a kind of general anger or a disgruntledness, I think is a better way of putting it, against the kind of sitting elites. And it's expressing itself in these sorts of odd ways. I think the five-star movement in Italy is, in a way, an early version of this. You know, the five-star movement is one that has been around for some time. And Italian politics has been notoriously sclerotic. You know, I mean, everyone ridicules, Berlusconi as a politician. But, you know, he was the first leader to actually survive one election to another in an Italian cycle since the Second World War, which speaks a lot. And I think it was in the wake of that that you had this real anger in Italy, this public sort of disgust at the sort of political system that gave Beppe Grillo the sort of movement to come in. I think what's interesting in some ways in the Italian specific context is actually that Matteo Renzi, the prime minister, is in a way a reflection of this as well. And in a way, he's managed to sort of capitalize it in a more mainstream way and is trying to sort of reform it. But I think the fact that you still have the five-star movement able to capture, you know, the sort of the mayoralties in two of Italy's bigger cities, Rome and Turin, you know, reflects the fact that notwithstanding this sort of national leader who has managed to kind of capitalize on the sentiment of it, you still have a lot of anger that's out there and specifically within these sort of municipalities.
I think one of the most interesting things is, if it, to the extent this is reflected nationally, Brexit, Trump and so on, it's how it's channeled in very different ways in different places. What is the target? Corruption has not been a big subject of discussion in the United States or the UK. It is, of course, in the Rome mayor elections. But we have other targets. We have the democratic deficit. We have Brussels. In America, it's things like the establishment, which, of course, is why both Trump and Sanders supporters have some common ground in pushing back against an establishment candidate. So what I'm really interested in is not just this populist wave of pressure, this upswell, but the way in which it's being sprayed in different places in different countries.
Well, on that sort of broader, almost anti-establishment point, I guess a lot of people looking at the Italian case specifically would say, well, why hasn't the centre-right benefited at all here, given what we've been seeing recently? Is that just part and parcel, Raffaello, of exactly the same problem?
The centre-right in Italy is actually fairly fragmented. At the same time, you've got a sort of number of leadership figures that have continued to rule. Berlusconi's party, Forza Italia, continues to play a role. He's still sort of in the background of it, even though he can't stand anymore after his conviction. You've got the Lega Nord, the sort of very aggressive anti-immigrant, you know, UKIP party in Italy that talks about the north sort of breaking away from the south, which is quite strong in some parts. You haven't got the same sort of coherent narrative on the right to sort of mobilize in around a specific individual. Instead, you have got a kind of centrist party around Renzi, which is able to do reasonably well. And actually, I mean, you know, while movement, Five Star Movement did win pretty much in all the mayoralties where they ran, you know, the centre-left didn't do too badly, actually, in some of the places where it was running as well. So, you know, I think Renzi clearly has seen, and he can see this, he's taken a bit of a beating, he's stood back from it, but, you know, it's really a case of him struggling with the kind of far left and this populist movement, rather than him having the struggle against the right, who are fighting, actually, in other parts of the Senate.
That's in much of Southern Europe, where sort of sees the economic crisis hit quite badly, and we see high levels of unemployment. The centre-right has a tough job, and in some way, the UK is an anomaly in terms of its willingness to not just elect, but a majority government a year ago. But of course, you're still seeing those pressures on the left build up even here as well.
We're going to talk more about the situation in this country as we tick towards the Brexit day, or potentially not Brexit, all will be revealed. But let's head to
Insider
the US.
Information.
Well, possibly. Let's head to the
bookies.
To the US. You mentioned Donald Trump. Now, after selling his political brand so effectively, many would assume Trump could sell anything, but finally, falling poll numbers suggest the fad may be wearing off somewhat. Interestingly, the list of companies backing away from involvement at the forthcoming GOP convention in Cleveland is growing. You've had JP Morgan Chase, Ford declining to sponsor the event, tech giant Apple is following suit. Meanwhile, the list of big Republican names who plan to skip the event is probably even longer. 2012 nominee Mitt Romney, 2008's John McCain, George W. Bush, and the rest of the Bush clan are all saying, oh, well, perhaps not this time. Who will be there, Shashank, and how bad a position will they find when they do get there?
I was staggered to learn from the New York Times story saying corporate donors don't give much. Apple only gives $150,000. And I thought, well, you know, A, these are remarkable sums, of course. If anyone gave the Tory convention or the Labour Party convention that much money, this would fund it for a couple of years.
They do give
I think.
That to both the Democrats and the Republicans.
Of course, hedging their bet. But in a more substantive way, who will be there? Well, I think the most interesting and you know, tortured figure will be Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, who has made the horribly ill-fated decision to give an early endorsement to Trump after a bit of dithering. And then promptly, of course, Trump questioned the legitimacy of a Mexican-born, or not even Mexican-born, a judge of Mexican heritage. Extraordinary comment. Ryan said this was not a blank check, his support, but he's in a terrible, terrible position. He really should have stepped down a while ago, because now, if he oversees a Trump victory and goes to hell in a handcart, Ryan will be, you know, we're seeing some people talk about Vichy Republicans. collaborators within. Or if he steps down, he'll look like a fool for having placed his own stamp of approval on Trump. But many people I see within the party itself have this dilemma as to, do they try and tame his impulses from within, hoping for cabinet positions or undersecretary of state positions, or do they do the moral thing and step back and say, after these types of comments, we will not facilitate a candidate who is so repugnant. We will take the hit for 4 years and regroup around the centrist.
So, Raffaele, what's happened here? I mean, there's no surprises that, you know, politicians make decisions or statements or the back candidates that's politically expedient from one moment to the other. With someone like Paul Ryan, he's backed him, then he's constantly rebuking him. He's saying to people, well, I wouldn't ever say vote against your conscience. What is the game he's playing? It's so baffling. Is it just everyone lost all control of their faculties in the US?
I know if everyone saw this, but there was an interview in the Sunday Times with Trump. Times, I cannot remember which one, went over, you know, London Times I'm talking about, not the New York Times, went over and sort of followed him between two of his events and interviewed with him. And what was interesting was you read the interview and actually, you know, he came across as a fairly reasonable person, you know. And you've seen a number of these and a few sort of interviews and op-eds that have been placed here and there where fairly sensible people are saying, well, actually, you know, if you really talk to Trump, he's not as, you know, bonkers as some of these statements he makes. So I think obviously he's able to project a kind of image of himself as a person who is actually reasonable and is doing these things because he knows that this is what he needs to get elected. But then once he's in power, he knows that, you know, there are certain things that you need to do and you need to govern more towards the center. And I think that sort of ability to project is something that maybe we don't see because we see the sort of, you know, big statements he makes and these sort of horrendous things he sort of will come out with here and there. But obviously, behind closed doors or in a more closed setting, he's able to persuade people like Paul Ryan, who is not an unsensible person, you know, and is not someone who's risen to that position within the Republican Party without knowing how to play politics and without knowing, you know, where what is achievable and what is not. So I think that Trump is able to project something in a more closed door setting that persuades people in a certain direction, but then apparently seems to continue to think it's necessary outside to project this other thing. The other thing I noticed today about the Trump campaign was the leader, one of the managers, Lindowski. Right? Mm. Yeah, Corey Lewandowski stepped down, right?
A reporter.
Right.
I think he's pushed, yeah.
Oh, whatever. He's left the campaign, which is never a good sign, frankly, if you're losing your campaign management this late in the game in some ways, makes me wonder if the whole thing is going to actually implode at the end of the day. But I still think that obviously Trump there is still this dilemma within the Republican Party. This man who's been chosen by the party, you know, unless we want to completely destroy ourselves, we've got to kind of go with him. And the question is, how do you kind of make this work? And I think he just keeps poisoning the well for people who are trying to do that. But I think that they still feel that they must try to.
I think it goes the other way too. For Trump himself, he also needs a little bit of Republican help, right? He's kept a fairly small staff. He hasn't spent too much of his own money. The Republican Party, like many...
him and a Twitter account, right? That's the campaign.
And that's been profoundly effective. But of course, he needs data. He needs data about voters. He needs a party machine. And so he also knows that he must make some accommodations to that. So I wonder if there's a kind of balance of terror between Trump and his own party in some fashion.
The balance of terror, that's a sobering thought. Just on the convention, it's interesting, obviously we've got these high profile donors who are perhaps not going to be sponsoring or appearing, other notable characters we've mentioned, and it's interesting, Shashank, people are even saying, like, who's actually going to speak? And there's this spectre of Trump delivering the addresses every day, presumably sort of broadly in support of himself.
Presumably his fantasy.
I mean, is this I mean, people are saying it's an unprecedented chapter in, you know, American politics, really. Could this convention be truly era defining in that it could essentially just be Donald Trump talking to himself?
I think there's two issues. One is, there was a phase when we thought there might be a write-in challenge and someone like the party may coalesce around a centrist figure like Romney, who only 4 years ago was considered, you know, about as dull as a dish sponge, but suddenly seems incredibly appealing as a candidate. That possibility now appears dead. And so there's this tragic inevitability, this sense of real horror. The other aspect of it is, I think, there is serious concern about the possibility of violence at the convention or, you know, political contention at the edges. We've seen how Trump has judiciously mobilized supporters, including to use force against his adversaries, against protesters. Mm-hmm. We know the convention will attract enormous opposition and protest on the streets. We've been here before in American history, and there have been very tragic events in American political conventions, of course, the killing of Bobby Kennedy in the 1960s. So I wouldn't rule out the really ugly side of this politics coming to the fore, and things that we thought were sort of extinct in Western democracies, being violence being used to settle political scores, coming out at the edges. I think that's a really concerning prospect for the convention.
Rafa, we're going to talk more in the programme about Brexit, and there's other sort of potential ugly ramifications, I guess, depending on either way, which that vote goes later in the week. What about this ugliness in Western politics? I mean, is Shashank right? We thought maybe these days of this really intensely bitter relationship, really almost hate-filled rhetoric, were maybe things of the past. To a degree, did the political classes become a bit complacent about the threats? Were these things always bubbling just under the surface?
I mean, I think there's an element of complacency within it. But I think there's also one of the things which has struck me in the sort of Brexit conversation is I got approached by a friend who works in a think tank in a faraway land. And they were trying to find someone who could, you know, show up, who could write something for them explaining the Brexit case, right? And, you know, I sat there writing my mind, who could I get? Who do I get asked to do this? And I really couldn't think of anyone, right? And except for sort of political figures who I know are doing it. Within the sort of community of academics and think tankers, there's a fairly shallow pool of people here in London, I think, who are really looking towards that case. And, you know, I told this person back, I was like, well, I'm sorry about this. And actually their response was, doesn't that say a lot about the disconnect between elites and the public? Mm. Because, you know, these polls aren't lying. They are going out. And if you go look at some of the reporting we've seen here in the UK or even in the US around sort of Trump, they go into sort of, you know, deepest parts of the Midwest or something, or Alabama, where we just don't go or particularly have a sense of what's going on. And there, the anger against the sort of center is so completely different. And I think that there's this sort of this missing element of it, of we don't have any sense of what's going on there. They don't particularly have a voice. And in some ways, what we're seeing is that kind of a reaction. And the problem is that reaction is coming out in a very kind of echo chamberish way through social media, where you can kind of shout at each other very loudly and you can only get information, or you can go selectively get your sort of read on what's happening from a whole list of people who are advancing your sort of fanatical view. And then that's all you'll ever consume. And so this idea of a sort of moderated political debate and conversation just is kind of gone.
But I think party elites have also fanned that sense of popular anger for their own ends and worsened it. And I'm not just talking over the past year, although things like Gove dismissing experts and expertise is just absolutely appalling. The Minister of the Armed Forces, Penny Mordaunt, effectively lying brazenly about the nature of Turkish accession to the EU in a way that is totally dishonest. A minister making these comments. But even further back, I see the genesis of Trump as being in the Tea Party and their willingness to bend truth, to play to the worst prejudices of these people who are their natural constituency, perhaps, but who have distorted views on immigrants, on Muslims, on many factors, including world trade and so on. And even Clinton is being pulled to the left on many of these issues that she once supported. If elites are pandering to these sentiments, I just can't see how that will dampen them. I think it will worsen them.
Right, no, exactly. When the Republican Party says, we will not work with anything that this president puts before us in Congress, I mean, the natural evolution is that, okay, well, they're the enemy, so we must fight them in every single way that we can, rather than, well, you know, this is a democracy, we rule by a majority, but you know, they work with the minority because we're all working together to build a better society. You know, if the line that you're taking is so violently negative, then you're going to get this kind of reaction, you know, and people will say, well, okay, so that's what the acceptable political debate is. So I will follow that line and you'll take that to an extreme.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Shashank Joshi and Raffaello Pantucci are my guests today. We'll have more on Brexit and we'll be asking questions like, why is anti-immigrant sentiment soaring in areas where there are very few migrants? All that and more still to come. Stay tuned.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto and New York City. In Singapore, our bureau chief is Nolan Giles.
I think for Monocle, the news that we're after isn't your ordinary what's big on Channel News Asia kind of news. It's the stories that are a little bit harder to find, the stories that you have to dig a little bit deeper. And the way that the team operates here from the Singapore Bureau is we're often dispatched to different countries in the region, to different cities, to travel, to explore, to meet people, to be on the ground and be in the action and build a strong contact base.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Ticking towards 20 minutes past the hour, this is Midori House. Still with me, Tom Edwards, Shashank Joshi and Raffaello Pantucci. Prime Minister Boris Johnson Just a few months ago, it might have seemed like a rather remote possibility, but should the UK vote to leave the EU this week, Britain's political landscape will be, well, frankly, unrecognisable, and its figurehead could be the former London mayor. There'll be international repercussions too, for sure. But will it be the first of many steps, potentially, towards an increasingly isolationist international politics? Raffaello Pantucci, do you think that it's too early? Well, it's clearly guesswork about Thursday, because it seems to be on a knife edge here in the UK, but if Britain votes to leave the EU, does that mark the way for other European countries? Does it offer up a template for the US to pursue this increasingly isolationist position?
I mean, I think that the repercussions sort of globally about isolationism, I think, will be very difficult to predict, quite frankly. But I think within a European context, it is going to have negative ramifications, not only to the United Kingdom, but also across Europe. It will set a precedent. There are other European countries that are not entirely happy with being in the EU. And if they start to peel away, then you'll start to question the whole coherence of the entire structure. And that will have massively negative repercussions across the continent, as well as here in the United Kingdom. So I think that there's a very real potential for some sort of major problem and crisis within the EU in particular. I think more globally, you know, there's been a move towards kind of, you know, isolationism in many ways for some time in some countries. I mean, if you look at, I would argue, if you look at the United States and the president, Barack Obama, he's been a sort of president who's been very hesitant about foreign policy, you know, been very hesitant about getting engaged in things abroad, and seems much more concerned with, you know, things at home. And when he looks abroad, looking more towards opportunities rather than problems. And the opportunities he tends to be in Asia. So the sort of whole foundation of the Transatlantic Alliance and a lot of these sorts of things have not been necessarily as given in the same sort of way that we see him. So I'm not saying that, you know, he disregards NATO. He clearly works very closely with NATO and is, you know, I think at the Warsaw Summit we're going to see a recommitment to a lot of the things that NATO is doing. But I think there is generally a kind of sense of, you know, well, America, we should worry about our national priorities before worrying about sort of global issues.
I sort of slightly disagree with even the premise of your question, which is, yes, there is an isolationist aspect to this. Of course there is. You're pulling away from a union and keeping them distance. But regardless of the feasibility of this, I do think some of the most intelligent Brexit voices, those like Gove and others, have tried to root this in a vision of a UK that is able to strike out and engage directly with new poles in the world, whether that is the Anglophone, the Commonwealth, the BRICS, rising powers. Now, I don't think this is feasible in the way they think it is, for a host of reasons.
Do they even think it's feasible? Or are they just, is this a sop to people who say, well, hang on, what are the options?
I genuinely don't think someone like Dan Hannan thinks this is impossible. I think they genuinely think if they work hard enough, they can reorient our entire trading and investment relationship to more dynamic parts of the world like China and India. Now, we don't need to get into the economic feasibility of this, and there's open questions as to whether we'd be at the back of the queue, as Obama said, on trade deals with the United States, whether in fact we have negotiating power outside of the EU as a big, powerful customs union. But the point is, I think we would still be active and powerful members of NATO, and the ambition, if not the feasible reality, is that we would be looking to other parts of the world that are less politically stagnant and less economically stagnant. So I sort of have to give a little bit of credit, I think, to the Brexiteers here, even if the ideas may be quite fuzzy.
Raffaello, do you think that there are other parts of their, people talk about sovereignty on the Brexiteer side, and they say, well, again, hang on a minute, what does that really mean? People talk, you know, pejoratively about, you know, the sovereignty that we've ceded to Brussels, this sort of thing. Are these just politically expedient arguments, or, you know, are we too quick to be very dismissive, do you think, of some of the Brexiteer points of view?
But I mean, I just don't think that they're accurate in a lot of these contexts. I don't think that the UK has not done things internationally because Brussels told them not to. You know, I think the UK clearly went ahead with its whole sort of, you know, its orientation towards China, developing a very close relationship with the Chinese, rolling out the red carpet when Xi Jinping came to town. And that was done, you know, not to the total joy of a lot of people in Brussels. I remember hearing about it from a lot of them. If you think about what happened in Libya, that was, you know, a few member states that decided we should bulldoze ahead and do something. It was not an EU, you know, and I think that if you were to go to Brussels, you probably hear a lot more cautious voices.
But it's the economics we're talking about here, right? It's the economics. It's the ultimately, the EU is a customs union. We can't sign trade deals with other countries as Australia has with the United States. So it's really an argument on an economic, and we're already having multiple arguments here. The argument
about
isolation
versus... But it's unrealistic to think that it's a country of 60 million or 70 million people is going to have greater clout in a conversation on trade with a country like India, a country like China, a country like Brazil, than a customs union or a trade bloc of 450 million people, which is frankly going to be able to punch a lot higher. I mean, you know,
on balance,
also,
I
what
agree,
does the US, what does the United Kingdom trade with these sorts of countries? You know, the UK remains a sort of services-based economy that is sort of not really got, you know, widgets and things that other countries necessarily need. You know, we're not Germany that manufactures, you know, big hardware that, you know, the Chinese desperately need or whatever else. It's a very different sort of economy. So I don't know that I actually buy this sort of logic that says that, you know, oh, well, you know, if we were unshackled of the EU, we'd suddenly be able to do all this incredible trade and whatever else. I mean, frankly, we do that trade already in a lot of cases. And yeah. I think that the other mythical trade just doesn't exist here. You know what I mean? I don't think we have the companies that are doing it.
In fact, one thing I worry about is the way in which a post-Brexit internationalism, an attempt to curry favour with the Chinese, with the Russians, with the Brazilians and others, may in some cases actually cut against our core security relationships with the United States and with NATO allies in Europe. Especially, of course, I don't need to go elaborate on what deeper economic engagement Beijing and Moscow might mean for our, you know, commitment to things like European sanctions on Russia, which are very, very important. Mm-hmm. So actually, I wonder if Brexiteers have fully thought through the congruence, the compatibility between what they themselves acknowledge will be the bedrock military relationship NATO and this globe-trotting economics and deal-making that they see as being a substitute for the European engagement.
Could it be that some of these politicians haven't necessarily taken the long-term view?
Are you suggesting that the Leave camp has incredible preparation for the next week's referendum?
Just briefly, on the immigration issue, though, it's a lot of talk about all these different issues of national autonomy or economics. But we often see it come back to this issue of immigration, and many members of the British public who are polled place it, I think it's somewhere around 70%, as being, you know, the critical issue. Are we risking ending up with a country that's riven? We've got a lot of metropolitan people, younger people who are very pro-Remain, who don't have hang-ups about migrants and the contribution that migrants make net to GDP. And then a group, principally a lot of older people, often not in the big urban centres, for whom it's the decisive issue. Whatever happens on Thursday, Raffaello, do you think that we could be looking at a kind of an enduring schism over this?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, it's very poisonous, the sort of atmosphere that you see in. But I think the one thing that's interesting is you don't see it coalescing around party divides, you know. And so for this to become a sort of enshrined, except if you're talking about UKIP or these other sort of marginal parties. And so that, to me, says that actually if the immigration question becomes the core one, it does seem to be the mobilizing factor that the sort of Brexit campaign use. I don't know necessarily that that would translate on a sort of national level, though, you know, you could see maybe the Tory party sort of hinting in that direction at a sort of general election, because it would feed a base that they feel they have to sort of lock down. But I think that the thing about immigration is it is very much a kind of an issue that is used in a very incorrect way. And I don't just say that as a sort of, you know, as an elitist sitting in London. I mean, it's, you know, the details that are pointed out are incorrect. You know, this idea that 90 million Turks are suddenly going to pop up on you is just not realistic in any feasible way. You know, these waves of migrants from Syria that are coming, well, they're not coming to the United Kingdom. You know, they're actually staying in Germany and on the continent. You know, if you look at immigrants and you look at all, I think, economics which I've seen, which sort of look at, you know, immigration versus economic, you know, growth or decline, they all point to migrants bringing economic benefits and, you know, helping grow an economy rather than shrinking it. So it all feels to me like it's essentially a very kind of a thing that people mobilize around in this sort of otherness, and we're angry in general, and so the other becomes the foreigner who you can sort of blame for everything. And that is a very sad sort of politics, but I think it's just kind of dog whistle politics being used now to advance a cause rather than a sort of deeper ingrained thing. But, you know, maybe that's just me sitting in London and missing out this conversation that's happening outside.
Shashank, very, very briefly, because time is short, any chance of a breakout of a more edifying rhetoric in the last couple of days before the vote on Thursday?
Well, the only thing is that we've seen, I think, Nigel Farage rather embarrassed by his unveiling of this Breaking Point poster with its similarity to sort of some Nazi propaganda. And this incredibly unfortunate timing on the day before Joe Cox's tragic murder by what appears to be a far-right extremist. It seems to be the case. Now, that seems to have restrained everyone a little bit. So I'm not sure about edifying rhetoric, but I do think this has had a sobering effect on many, many people, and it has tempered their language. And I hope that that carries through in the coming weeks, which could otherwise have been even more ugly than they have been.
Shashank, thanks for your time. As always, Raffaella Pantucci, too, thanks for being our guest today on Midori House. Today's programme was produced by Ben Rylan, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Cy Villafuerte, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. More music next at 1900 Culture with Robert Bound, and more on the day's big stories on the Monocle Daily, 2200 London time. This show's back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London. Do join us then. Goodbye.